This interview with Kara Lee was conducted on January 27, 2023 in New Paltz, New York, in a group setting. Other voices on this recording are Fran Dunwell, Nancy Beard, and Betsy Blair. The interviewer is Elizabeth Lojudis.
My name's Kara Lee. Lee's my last name. And I was born in 1952 in Philadelphia. And a very suburban, leafy, green part of Philadelphia. My dad was a pediatrician, and my mother was his helpmate. I don't think he could have been the great doctor he was without my mother. She was a homemaker. She was trained as a musician, but she was a homemaker. Some of the things I remember about growing up in Philadelphia is that it was like there were no property boundaries. All of the children in the neighborhood just roamed all over the neighborhood, and the neighbors all expected that. You know, our parents would let us out. They wouldn't know where we were. We'd come back at the end of the day. I remember that we had a very big beech tree in the front yard, and we loved climbing to the very top, and it was a very big beech tree. And, you know, beech trees are very prone to having things carved in them because the bark is very smooth. So we'd climb all the way up into the top and we'd carve things up there. And after I went to college, that beech tree got cut down. And my mother said, "I had no idea you were all the way up there." Anyway, it was really great to grow up in a place where you could just roam. There was a pond near the house, but you had to cross three different people's properties to get there, that kind of thing. So anyway, the other part of growing up that I think made me love the out-of-doors is that my father was born in Maine. So we would spend about a month every summer in Maine. And he was quite a... he had a little kind of runaround boat, and we'd just go island hopping and camping on islands, and we spent a lot of time on the water and a lot of time puddling around on the edge of the water. And I think it became like a deep part of me, the beauty and the out-of-doors there, matched with the out-of-doors living on the edge of Fairmount Park in Philadelphia. I went to a public school that was nearby. I still marvel at the fact that there were 50 children in my class with one teacher. Those teachers were amazing. We sat at desks that were bolted to the floor. They had ink wells. We also had air raid drills where we'd go out in the hall. We'd either go under our desk. We couldn't go under those desks, but we'd go out in the hall and sit the way Betsy described as air raid drills. When I got to seventh grade, like you said, you had the privilege of going to Emma Willard. I had the privilege of going to a Quaker high school in Philadelphia that was about 5 miles from where we lived, so I would ride the trolley car every day to school. And as you may know, Quaker schools are based on Quaker principles of appreciating people as individuals and taking them as they are, generally pretty liberal. So we were, at that time, being exposed to a lot of information about civil rights and the environment. And when I was a senior in high school, was the first Earth Day, 1970, and I remember riding my bicycle to the first Earth Day event, which was in downtown Philadelphia. At Germantown Friends School, we had a remarkable teacher named Mr. Platt, and he taught geology or earth sciences and anthropology. And he just exposed us to so many wonderful things. He took us out in the field. as I recall, the way you got a good grade was there were points assigned for books, and the more books you read, the more points you got, and the better you did. And it was a great teacher. I went on to go to Kirkland College, which was in upstate New York. It was the first new women's college in many, many years in the Northeast, and it was associated with Hamilton College, which had been there for a very long time, and their idea was to expand Hamilton College to include, I think the vision was to include an engineering school, a medical school, a women's college. They got as far as creating Kirkland College, which is a women's college, and that was the end of that experiment. But it was an interesting place to go because the people who had come together to create the school were from Barnard College and other women's colleges. They were really interested in the women's movement and feminism, and the women at Kirkland College were from all over the United States, all over the world, and the men at Hamilton College were from Herkimer and, I don't know, Schenectady, upstate New York. So the two student bodies were so different. And I knew I was interested in environmental science. I had a deep appreciation for nature, and I knew I wanted to take biology and geology and so on. And all those courses were offered at Hamilton. Kirkland had a botanist, an ecologist, who was my advisor. She was great, but there weren't a lot of science classes to be had. So I went over to Hamilton, and I think Fran will attest to the fact that, because she went there too, the Hamilton professors were really not that welcoming to Kirkland students. And the biology classes were designed for pre-med, and the chemistry class, we were told right at the beginning, was designed to weed people out. As, you know, a test as to whether you had the medal for medical school, that kind of thing. The geology classes were teaching people to go on to become, I mean, it was basic geology, but those were people who were going to go work for big oil or mineral extraction companies or whatever. So it just wasn't really working for me. So I came home after my sophomore year, and I told my parents I was dropping out. They were shocked and dismayed, but I ended up having a pivotal year. I don't remember exactly how I made the connection, but I think through my father. He had a connection with a woman scientist who was at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, and her name was Dr. Ruth Patrick. She was quite a groundbreaker. She was trained as a limnologist, and she had developed a technique for determining water quality in streams that involved hanging glass slides mounted in a rack that would go in a stream. Diatoms would grow on the glass slides, and then they'd bring it into the lab to assess what types of diatoms were there as an indication of stream water quality. So that was kind of her claim to fame. But she had started a watershed management consulting firm that was embedded at the Academy of Natural Sciences. And so I wrote her a letter at my father's urging. And to my surprise, I was offered an interview at her watershed management consulting firm. And I just have to say that the night before my interview, I went back home to my parents' neighborhood to go trick-or-treating. What was I, age 18, 19? And I made myself a costume. I dressed up as a crow. He had on orange stockings, black whatever, a beak and all this stuff. I had a lot of fun. I went with a friend. So the next morning I went down to downtown Philadelphia to go to the Academy of Natural Sciences, and I walk in to have my interview. And the man who's interviewing looks at me and he says, "I think you were in my living room last night dressed as a crow. Am I right?" Anyway, I got the job. And it was a really interesting job. The project they had me working on was to make maps of land use along the Delaware River. And I had the opportunity to go out with scientists in the field to interview people and look at land use. But I needed to learn how to do basic cartography. And at that time, you know, you used India ink and rapidographs and what was that paste on stuff? you know, to show the different textures and letterpress.
Something like that.
Something big like that. It was all by hand.
Yep.
So I needed to learn how to do that. So I got teamed up with people from the University of Pennsylvania Landscape Architecture School who were doing a lot of land use work. And that's where I learned how to make all those maps. At that time, the University of Pennsylvania was starting a new environmental studies program with a guy named Bob Gegengack, who was a geologist. So I signed up and I took his inaugural classes as a non-matriculating student. I was able to do quite a lot of field work doing that project, and I took limnology courses also at the University of Pennsylvania that year. So for me, it was a pivotal year. I went back to Kirkland College knowing the kind of work I wanted to do. And Kirkland being the liberal place it was, gave me credit for the work I had done so that I was able to rejoin my class and graduate on time, which was fantastic. I met a lot of people from Long Island and New York City when I was at Kirkland, a lot of women, and some of my friends. I was offered a job at the Academy of Natural Sciences when I graduated. But my friends from college were saying, "Come on, come to New York City and, you know, you can share an apartment with us and stuff like that." So I did pick up and move to New York City, not really knowing what I was going to do. And I went to visit the American Museum of Natural History because having been at work at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, I had an appreciation for the public-facing side of the Academy, which was a museum. And I thought, oh, this would be an interesting place to work. So I kind of made my way to the education department, and I found the curator of education, and I had a conversation with him, and they must have needed somebody because they offered me a job. And so I spent about 18 months as an educator at the American Museum of Natural History, which was a fantastic experience, because I got to know so many, the educators, but so many people who worked behind the scenes. And, excuse me, unfortunately, I was the last person hired at the museum before the fiscal crisis of 1975 in New York City. And I was hired as a city employee. So I was educating, school groups and all different kinds of groups that were coming through the museum. So I was sorry to lose the position, but I'd had a wonderful time. And I'd been exposed to the notion of travel in order to explore different environments. And I had a friend who had set off to do a trip across Africa and had ended up in Botswana and was teaching school. So I went for a visit. And I arrived in a large rural community on the edge of the Kalahari. And lo and behold, their science teacher in the high school was on medical leave and they were desperate for a teacher. So I said, okay, I'll do it for a semester. And as I recall, I took my return airplane ticket and I cashed it in and I bought a beat up old Land Rover. And I ended up staying for 18 months. And I was teaching students who ranged in age from about 13 to 20. I was teaching a Scottish science curriculum that covered physics, chemistry, and biology. And it was a fantastic experience. To live in a agrarian subsistence community. It was a large community. The country had been a British protectorate, but it had been democratic for 10 years. It had its own currency. many of the men in the village would go to South Africa to work in the mines. Big buses would come through and pick them up. It was very close to the South African border. But, through that process, I developed a real appreciation for living in a third world country. I mean, I certainly never experienced anything like that before. So, no running water, no electricity. People living on maybe $200 a year, had the opportunity, because I had the beat-up old truck, to go on camping trips in the Kalahari and throughout South Africa, which was also quite an experience because apartheid was still in full swing. But anyway, I eventually was ready to go home. Went back to New York City, and at this point I felt like I was an educator. And so I went to work for a small not-for-profit as their education director. And they had a grant from DEC, New York State DEC, to educate about urban forestry. So the importance of street trees. So we had a curriculum. And we took it to all five boroughs, children in all five boroughs. I managed a team of five teachers who took their materials and their equipment out to schools to teach people about the importance of street trees. At the same time, running a YCC program. So I had a team of young people who were working on park rehabilitation in New York City. And these were parks that are now gems. At that time, they were completely run down, mostly inhabited by, drug dealers and homeless people. And so it was a very challenging thing, but also a great experience. So I had another pivot point at that point in that I realized I wasn't cut out really to be an educator. I wanted to do something where I felt I could affect more change. Certainly you change people by educating them, but I came to understand that I was much more interested in environmental policy. So that's when I decided to go to graduate school. And I felt like if I was going to stay in what at that time felt like a marginal field, I needed to go to a school with good name recognition. And the Yale Forestry School was not that far away, so it was the only place I applied. And I think it's important to recognize that in the 70s, there were already people who were studying environmental science. There's no doubt about that. But there wasn't the wealth of environmental programs, careers. It was still uncharted territory in a lot of ways. And again, that's why I felt like it was important to go to a school that was well-established, well-recognized. I didn't really know what I was getting in for. But I was accepted. I remember feeling that the calculus requirement was a kind of tall order for me because I stopped taking math in 11th grade. And I remember talking to the dean of the school and saying, I'm not sure I have time to take a calculus course between now and September. And he said, well, you do live in New York City, and there are quite a few places you could take a calculus course. And I said, well, let me be honest with you. I don't know if I can pass a calculus course between now and September. Do you remember the calculus requirement? He said, we'll wait for you. So I went to Columbia, and I took a calculus course that met for 4 hours a day and had about 6 hours of homework, and I got a B plus, and it was really good for my self-confidence. Anyway, I had been out of college for 6 years when I got to the forestry school, and it was such a privilege to be there. In terms of the people I met, the coursework, the forestry school, in the scheme of things, was also extremely liberal in that you could take courses anywhere in the university. And I didn't stray too far, but I took courses at the business school, the law school. I took every policy course I could, and but I also had the opportunity to take forestry classes, field classes. We all went through something called terrestrial ecosystems that was everybody's favorite class. So it was absolutely a fabulous experience. And by that time, I was firmly settled in New York City, but I'd started coming to the Hudson Valley. And I started coming to the Hudson Valley as a volunteer on the Hudson River Sloop Clearwater. And it was such an incredible experience to go 90 miles north of New York City and be in the Hudson Valley. Because growing up in Philadelphia, I tried to get out of the city, but the sprawl of Philadelphia was so deep and so far that you really had to drive quite a long way to get out of the city. And in New York, you could take a train or you could take a short car ride and be in this completely different world. So I was very taken with the Hudson Valley, and I met my husband on the Hudson River Sloop Clearwater. He was the education director. So when I finished graduate school, I had kind of a choice of whether I was going to go back and do urban ecology and urban work or move to the Hudson Valley. And it wasn't a very hard choice, really, although I didn't really know what I would do. By that time, I knew Fran. I knew Betsy. Fran definitely was working on me to come to the Hudson Valley. Steve, my husband, was working on me to come to the Hudson Valley. So I moved in September of 1984, And Fran had been working for Scenic Hudson for I don't know how many years, but she had been the director and then the environmental director, I guess. And since she was moving on to the Hudson River Estuary Program, they were looking for somebody to fill that slot. And so that's what I did. And I started working in the fall of 1984, and I was with Scenic Hudson for 17 years.